On Sports, Part 3, The Stadium. In the last segment, we covered Courtney's Law of Entertainment, which characterizes the inherent value of all entertainments. In this segment, we'll break down the value of America's stadium sports. Football, basketball, and baseball. This is where you'll find the biggest stars, the supergiants of the night sky. And it's funny how brightly some of those stars can shine, despite being disgusting human beings. Just look at the Ben Roethlisbergers and Michael Vicks of the world. It makes me wonder how far bad behavior can be pushed without disrupting the thick walls partitioning the character of an athlete off the field from his performance on it. If every time a little girl lost a tooth, Roethlisberger broke into that family's home, plucked that little girl from her bed, filled the bathtub as quietly as possible, and drowned her in it, but was responsible for 60 points every game, how would that influence the crowd? How many people would be willing to continue cheering? In baseball, the cheering corral would probably lose a few voices, as evidenced by the number of people who turn their backs on Barry Bonds for steroids when just about every NFL player is doing way bigger doses and nobody seems to be bothered. Or maybe they're all just really good at denial. But comparing the three sports, baseball, basketball, and football, baseball is the only one of those that, at the professional level, is still an interesting sport populated by actual athletes. This seems like a bold statement, but let me explain, and let me begin that explanation with football, then basketball, then baseball. Football. The game itself lasts hours, but only about 6% of those hours are spent doing anything. The other 94% is nothing. It's spent sitting, huddling, drinking juice, whatever. 94% of football is rest. See David Biderman's 2010 report in the Wall Street Journal. Baseball, which everyone thinks of as the waiting game, packs in about 64% more total action. See Steve Moyer's 2013 report in the Wall Street Journal. Football is the undisputed champion of waiting games. Even at the D1 college level, where it isn't strictly designed to include as many commercial breaks as possible, the average play lasts 5.25 seconds, and the average rest period between each play is 47 seconds, more than 9 times the duration. See the 2008 report by OC and Bishop in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. To me, the waiting itself, all that rest and downtime, isn't the problem, though. What's troubling is the need for that rest. In football, most of the athletes are a bunch of obese slobs who can't run more than 40 yards. Most can barely clear 10, and then they require a minute-long rest period before they have to do it again. But still, people regard them as athletic and fit and healthy. This is just as ridiculous as regarding firefighters as athletic and fit and healthy, firefighters who spend 90% of their work shifts playing Halo. Without getting into all the standard health markers, cholesterol, triglycerides, all the stuff that says both demographics are lucky to be alive, metabolic syndrome is a pretty inclusive summary of the whole picture. 1% of male college students have metabolic syndrome, see Huang and colleagues' 2004 article in the journal Diabetes Care. In comparison, 49% of collegiate linemen do, see Buell et al.'s 2008 article in the Journal of Athletic Training. If you're in college, you're 49 times more likely to have a lethally diseased metabolism if you're a lineman. Courtney, you're just looking at linemen. Nobody ever said linemen were healthy. I realize that. I'm just illustrating that practically half of all linemen have a metabolic disorder that results in the grossest, pudgiest, most out-of-shape physiques the human body is capable of achieving. But even if you remove every single lineman from the stats and only look at the remaining players, you're still looking at 14%. See Wilkerson et al.'s 2010 article in the Journal of Athletic Training. 14% of them have metabolic syndrome. That's 14 times the rate of their non-athlete counterparts. While it's never been measured, I would suspect the prevalence among age-matched males who play Dungeons & Dragons on a bi-weekly basis is no more than 7%, half the rate of the athletic football players, and 1/7 the rate of football's linemen. Obviously, all the health markers and cardiovascular disease risk factors, resting blood glucose, hypertension, etc., reflect this. But those aren't interesting. What's interesting is this. VO2 max is the gold standard in measuring cardiovascular capacity, meaning how long a guy can be active in bed before he just lies on his back and ceases all motion, pelvic or otherwise. Chip Kelly, University of Oregon's head football coach from 2009 to 2012, understood this. He realized collegiate football players were no more athletic on the field than they were in bed. Maybe that's why the majority of their sexual encounters are rape. And so he trained them to become actual athletes. He trained them to have a slightly less humiliating VO2 max. No longer would they merely be big guys who got in the way of other big guys. On the field, they would be capable of actual displays of athleticism, and off the field, sex that would be pleasurable for a woman. What happened? He was the most successful coach in the history of the school. During the 4 years in which Kelly was head coach, his team won 3 conference championships, going 33-3 in that conference, and he won 7 major Coach of the Year awards. And then he went pro. A bunch of teams wanted him, and he went with the Eagles. and he immediately became one of the three most powerful coaches in the NFL, one of only three that has all the power of a general manager. Kelly became one of the greatest things that's ever happened to the sport by making his athletes a tiny bit athletic, by giving them a VO2 max that was better than a chronic fatigue syndrome patient's. This is what enabled them to speed up the pace of the game, not sit around huddling and relaxing for a ridiculously long duration between every single play. Now they would just rush back to the line, go, 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 play, play, play. No more embarrassing, disgusting slobs pretending to be athletes. The metabolic panels of Kelly's players would be only slightly worse than the average Dungeons & Dragons player. And in consequence, the players on the opposing teams would spend the entire game sick, vomiting in their helmets and faking injuries to slow the game back down. Under Kelly's rules, football is still the slowest game in the universe, but at least it's catching up to baseball. Without Kelly, it's just a bunch of total non-athletes engaging in a total non-sport. Like sumo wrestling, it's an activity in which eligibility is merely a matter of body dimensions. Are you 6'6" and 330 pounds? Here's your contract and your first month's supply of syringes. Are you 10 feet tall? Well, then here's your basketball contract. Basketball is even worse than football, in that height is literally everything. Dennis Rodman illustrates this point pretty well. He was terrible in high school. He entered at 5'6" and graduated at 5'11". In between those two marks, he quit basketball. He wasn't good enough, i.e. tall enough, to get any playtime. All the other high school kids were better, so he quit. And after high school, Rodman went on to become a janitor at an airport. And that's when he hit his growth spurt, shot up to 6'7", and gave basketball another chance at a community college in Texas. And he turned out to be great, so he got recruited to play at a state college in Oklahoma, where he was also great, so he got drafted into the NBA, where he was also great, probably the best rebounder of all time. Would that greatness have come to him if he were a foot shorter? Of course not. He'd still be mopping airports. Before Rodman grew a foot, he couldn't even compete with high schoolers. After that foot, he became a Hall of Fame NBA player. Says a lot about the importance of height. In David Epstein's book, The Sports Gene, he calculates the odds of being an NBA player based purely on height. Among men who are between the ages of 20 and 40, who stand at a height of 6'0" to 6'2", the odds of being a current NBA player are 1 in 5 million. But in that same age group, if you're 7 feet tall, the odds that you're currently playing in the NBA are 17%. And most people who are 7 feet tall are not athletic. They have hormonal conditions and diseases that make them that tall. And still, great shot at signing an NBA contract. Just look at Manute Bol. He was born in Sudan and claims to have killed a lion with a spear. He made a big deal about that to everyone while he was in rehab, the clinic where I worked. That's how I know. When he came to the U.S., he was 7'7" with a wingspan of 8'6", and he weighed 180 pounds. Throughout his career, he gained a little weight, but never made it to 200 pounds. If he went to a strip club and planted himself sturdily enough on stage, I'm sure he could have received free acrobatic lap dances all night from confused strippers. Despite his ridiculous lack of physical prowess and overall athleticism, he was a legend in the game, one of the best shot blockers in the history of the sport. But imagine if he were 6 feet tall. At pounds per inch, he would weigh about 142.5 pounds. His peak weight would have been in the 150s, and his 100-meter dash time is probably about 10 minutes. Do you think he would have been in the NBA? 100% of the time, basketball fans respond to this by shouting the words, "Muggsy Bogues!" Okay, out of thousands of players, you've identified one exception who was made famous because of his height, not because of his stats. Yes, Bogues was 5'3", and he scored 7.7 points per game. And how many rebounds do you think he got? Do you think he could rebound anything when there's a Rodman on the court? And how many shots do you think he blocked? Do you think he and Manute Bol were in the same league there? He had 7.7 points per game. If you look at the overall NBA statistics, 250th place in per-game ratings is Michael Thompson. Michael wasn't very good, but he was 6'10", so that gave him 13.7 points per game. Bogues had 7.7. Out of thousands of players, he's the one exception that you know. And the only reason you know him is because of how crazy it was that a short person was actually in the NBA. That's why he's famous. After he retired, he coached women's basketball, and he was considerably shorter than every single woman on the team. Much more importantly, though, the shorter players in the NBA aren't actually their real heights. It's about wingspan. Like what I said about Manute Bol being 7'7" with an 8'6" wingspan. The average person has a height and wingspan that are roughly equivalent. The average NBA player has a wingspan that totally exceeds his height, by about 4.3%, give or take, year by year. So if you're 6 feet tall and in the NBA, you probably have a wingspan that's a little over 6'3". Go look up the wingspans of Rudy Gay, Kevin Durant, Derrick Rose, Dwight Howard, Bismack Biyombo. Those ones are funny. And it's a way to conceal one's true height as it applies to basketball. That's not to say that there's no athleticism to be displayed on the court. Certainly more than there is in football. There's speed, endurance, power, precision, quickness, dexterity. These components of athleticism are exhibited, but mostly in inner city street ball, where everyone's 5'10". At the professional level, they're all just 6'10". If all this really being tested is height and wingspan, it's a bit of a non-sport. If I were 10 feet tall, I'd already be in the Hall of Fame. It would take me one season to get there. Baseball, though, that's tough. Serious skill there. Imagine Manute Bol trying to play it. If he were at the plate, he would strike out every single time. If he were shortstop, he would miss every single ball, no matter how hard he applied himself, because he's not an athlete. But he was a total champ in basketball, where if you're tall enough, who cares if you're athletic? This is why I said the most interesting sport is, very clearly, baseball. It's the only one that's actually based on skill rather than body dimensions. I realize baseball is boring to watch, but not because it's a worse game. It's a way more interesting game. It's boring because there's less movement. People are captivated by anything that moves. Try to have a conversation with someone when something else in the room, right behind your conversation partner, is moving around a bunch. A dog is chasing its tail, someone is doing a shuttle run, even just something happening on television. Sit and talk to someone while the TV is on. If you have any manners at all, you'll feel guilty about how often you glance at it. People are inherently wired to notice and be captivated by moving things. There's a massive survival advantage to that. Not anymore, but human DNA hasn't changed since the neutering of predators and the invention of stadium sports. This is probably the biggest reason football and basketball now have a larger viewership than baseball, which in turn has a larger viewership than golf. I'm not talking about reading box scores or watching highlights. I'm talking about watching the whole event, start to finish. A bunch of quickly moving objects will garner the biggest audience. Why do you think football fills its hours of would-be stillness with instant replays, making you watch the exact thing you just finished watching 1 second ago? It's just movement. Make a bunch of things move on the TV and stupid people will watch it. But baseball doesn't have to rely on little tricks like move stuff around a lot to manipulate the brain dead. Likewise, and unsurprisingly, baseball doesn't have nearly the gambling draw that football and basketball have, that universal marker of underlying dullness. So next time you're sitting in front of your TV watching the big game, try to appreciate what it is that's being televised. Is it a bunch of unathletic men with 7-foot wingspans moving around a lot? Or a bunch of instant replays of men with metabolic syndrome running into each other? Or is there some sort of athleticism, some sort of skill that's being demonstrated independent of body dimensions and absent the necessity of a wager? CourtneyJensen.com